My name is Sunny Miller. I'm the director at Trap Rock Peace Center in Deerfield, Massachusetts. Thank you so much for coming this afternoon to the Veterans for Peace workshop on depleted uranium. We'll have four presenters. Our first is a veteran, Tom Gale, who's been working with Veterans for Peace, has been to Iraq, and has begun networking with Japanese. Today you'll hear of both local and international efforts to eliminate this very dangerous weapon. Tom Gale.
Good afternoon. My name's Tom Gale, and I'm from North Shore of Massachusetts. Born in Cambridge, right across the river, back during World War II. And I heard about the Veterans for Peace just before the Gulf War, 1990. And we started our chapter, John Shuchart, at his House of Peace up in Ipswich in August of 1990. And we are now co-sponsoring this convention. And a great job, very much in part to John. Thank you, John. Well, I started going to the conventions, and John, of course, highlighted what happened in Iraq because he was over there right after that first Gulf War ended, you know, within those days. And he kept that alive. But it was through going to these powerful conventions where I meet a lot of heroes that I met Dan Fahey in the Philadelphia Convention, and he talked about being self-taught expert on depleted uranium. And he sparked, I think, in all of us the urgency to learn more about it and do something about it. But it wasn't until a couple years later, in 2000, that Freddie Champagne came with news that we were going to go to Iraq on the first Iraq Water Project. And he talked me into it, and we were there in October of 2000. And it was a wonderful place, Iraq. We were really fearful of a lot of things, mosquitoes and the heat and lack of water and such things, and maybe even some violence. But the people there were wonderful. And then we went into the hospitals, and we saw the results of what they said, 10 times the original rate of cancer had occurred after the Gulf War. And we saw these children, these infants, that were very innocent as they could be. And they were missing hair. And they had their families with them, and the families were there to essentially be with them until they died. And we had heard a UNICEF report that 5,000 children under the age of 5 were dying each month. And coming back, it was just a month later that I met Steve Lieber up with the Merrimack Valley People for Peace. He came, and he was distributing this book, Discounted Casualties. And in it are just two-page interviews of people all around the world having something to do with uranium processing, depleted uranium. And Concord, Massachusetts was one of them, with StarMet. Shortly after that, his group put together a book called Children of the Gulf War. And in here are the children that I saw over there. And very well done, very effective. And they asked me to distribute it. And a year later, just last year, they, because of the Iraq War, again, the second Iraq War, the people in Hiroshima, calling themselves the Global Peacemakers, came out with another booklet. This booklet, of course, I'm proud to say that they asked me beforehand to write an article, and so I'm in there on page 45 about an activity that I just want to tell you very quickly about. Devin Hildreth, when she saw this, not this book, I'm sorry, it was this book. When she saw this book, she said, "Our Congress needs to see this." And so the two of us went down to Washington, D.C., and they drop-shipped 550 copies of The Children of the Gulf War, and we, with a couple of Ellen Barfield and several other Veterans for Peace members, distributed them to Congress in just 3 days. And one congressman said, "Thank you very much. I've been looking for this booklet." And now we have this, and this goes into the details and of what DU is. And it's something to read. I do not know whether DU will cause cancer in me or whether it does in anybody, but I know people have died. And if you have seen part of this, Doug Rockey, and others that have been exposed to it. And I think we need to help come up with an activity that will help to prove that it is, in fact, causing cancer to our soldiers and the people in Iraq, the people in Yugoslavia, and really put an end to depleted uranium weapons. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Tom Beale. And next joining us, Tom, thank you for bringing forward this all these books, which are so amazing. The Japanese have printed 15,000 copies of this book and expect to next translate it into Arabic.
50,000?
15,000.
50. I read the other day.
Oh, my.
That's the basis now of the peace movement in Japan, is an anti-DU.
Judy is our next speaker, and Tom told us a bit of his story, shows how people, one by one, are making a difference. Judy Skotnicki has been studying depleted uranium for 15 years, and it's because she resides in Concord, Massachusetts, only a mile and a half from the StarMet facility, which used to be called Nuclear Metals Incorporated, a primary manufacturer of the armor-piercing radioactive bullet, the DU Penetrator, which was used extensively in 1991. 320 to 350 tons of this weapon were used, and the StarMet site is now a Superfund site. She's a 1964 graduate of USMA.
He is.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jack. Jack here in support. That's the U.S.
Military
Academy.
I just like to make an editorial comment. As far as I know, first of all, I'm very proud to be a member of Veterans for Peace, and I don't need that. And secondly, as far as I know, I'm trying to find another soulmate from my classmate or from my school that is a member of Veterans for Peace. So if you know anybody that went to West Point and is now a member, please tell me.
Thank you. That personal appeal. So, Judy, tell us what you can about the homebound effects right here in the U.S. For your neighbors in Concord. May I pin this on you?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, having come from the last workshop where the young Iraqi veterans now returning spoke, and one of them is in the room, I'd like to thank you again and the other men and women who, yeah. who are finding their voices and speaking out. And I must say I was shocked to hear Mike Hoffman say, one of the Iraqi veterans returning, that they are still using depleted uranium in Baghdad. They are using it to shoot at buildings. So essentially what is being left in Baghdad is a radioactive wasteland. I don't know how far it goes, or anyway, I just felt myself inwardly just gasped that we have not been able to even stop that weapon from being used when it isn't. There's no war fighting going on, but they're fighting a building with it. So, what I want to come back to, though, is my own situation and how I got involved studying and educating myself and others about depleted uranium and something about what happened in those 15 years. First of all, most of you probably know, but I still like to say what depleted uranium is. It is called DU. It's a byproduct of the nuclear fuel cycle whereby nuclear weapons and nuclear power are fueled. It's a hazardous, dangerous material developed for warfare by the United States Army. DU is a radiological and chemical toxin. The only studies that have been done so far are not on humans who would have been exposed to DU, other than the limited group, the 30-some veterans who came from the first Iraqi war and were exposed to friendly fire, or their tanks were hit. But we know from rat studies now in this country that DU has the capacity to go into the sperm, cross the placenta, and that, in fact, you can have reproductive health effects from DU. And also, even before the first Iraqi war, special studies conducted for the armed services did assert that when inhaled or ingested, DU dust or particles could cause cancer, birth defects, or other illnesses. So that's the frame, is we knew that that was a possibility when those weapons were first used in warfare.
Who did that study?
It was done by the Army Radiological Institute. I can give you that information.
Alexandra Miller Armed Forces Radiobiology Research Institute,
right.
AFRI. Alexandra
AFRI,
Miller.
Right. Thank you.
And the presentation is available at our website. If you web search her name in the search, traprockpeace.org, you can hear the audio of her presentation at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
Thank you for giving that information. I tried to bring as much as I thought I might need today, but if you have any questions and for some reason none of us have the answer, we'll find it and get back to you, and we are sincere in that. In Concord, I know you would be interested what happened, because the penetrator was made in Concord for over 20 years, and in fact they had a reduction furnace at Nuclear Metals, the company that made the weapon, and so that they actually melted they made the DU penetrator taking the solid green salt and converting it to metal there. So we were exposed when there weren't even filters on the stacks in the community, and workers were definitely exposed to depleted uranium. So what kind of health effects? That's what people always want to know. That's what Akira Toshiro wanted to know when he came and interviewed us in Concord for the book that you've seen right here. We in Concord in the early 80s, the Mass Cancer Registry, we learned through the Mass Cancer Registry that male leukemia and male multiple myeloma in Concord was twice the state average. And Dick Clapp, the first director of the Massachusetts Cancer Registry, an epidemiologist who you can contact in this state and is also interviewed in this book, Dick said that the cancers were statistically significant in Concord, the male cancers, the multiple myeloma, and the leukemia are cancers that are known to be radiation sensitive. Now, however, even though we had that information, we did not know what work those men did or how long they lived in Concord. We could never get any agency, federal or state, to follow up and really find out more about who these people were who got these cancers. What did they do? So what happened is we tried to file a bill, which we did through our legislator and other legislators from other parts of the state where people were exposed to radioactive material through the nuclear industry in different forms. We could never get those bills out of committee. So even though we asked for worker studies at Nuclear Metals, we were unsuccessful in getting those. So what happened is the attention of our organization turned, while we remain concerned about the health effects, we turned to the environmental effects of DU, and that's where the story lies in Concord. Crew's main focus for 15 years has been on the environmental impact of nuclear metals, and you can go to our website and learn more, which is concordcrew.org, and you can see anybody who wants more information. I'm happy after this to provide that. I mean, take your name, address, and get in touch with you. But we now have in Concord a federal Superfund site as of 2001, and that took a lot of work on the part of citizens and scientists who cooperated with us, and in the beginning, nobody knew what depleted uranium was, so it was a long journey to get there, but we worked with our citizens in our own community, and nationally, we had a lot of help from the Military Toxics Project and worked with veterans like Dan Fahey and others, workers from other facilities like Nuclear Metals, Aerojet Ordnance in Tennessee. And you can see my husband brought radioactive weapons and waste in Concord. And we focused on the issue of DU because our community could not face it as a community, as a moral issue, as an issue that had consequences beyond Concord, that this company was there making this bullet because they filled the town with money, you know, hospitals, you know, school, scholarship, all of that. But when we did this, I've always felt it was a turning point in Concord, Jim and Jack, you know that, when we did this, because it made the larger Boston community and Concord look at this community for what we had done, taken radioactive waste, made a weapon that was used in the Gulf War, killed civilians and soldiers there, and was coming back to haunt us because it could be part of the Gulf War syndrome. So this is just some of the highlights that, you know, I bring out in what could – I could talk to you for – I could make the Guinness Book of Records talking about this, but I don't want to. And I will take a question when that's the right time. But I just want to tell you how we got a Superfund site at the Nuclear Metal site was because one thing that happened, the company was – started to excavate a holding basin that had 400,000 pounds of radioactive waste dumped into it from their manufacturing of the penetrator. And so we focused, citizens focused on this waste pit. And eventually the Army came up with $4 million to excavate the pit. And when 8,000 cubic yards of depleted uranium or radioactive waste were removed, the groundwater level tested in a well right next to that pit with the uranium waste, the groundwater tested 3,000 times safe drinking water level. And it was at this point, I think, that our State Department of Environmental Protection, who had been working with us, with citizens and with the community on this issue, they realized they had a problem beyond the state's ability to handle. And so through a process, which I'm not going to go into in detail, we were able to obtain a Republican governor, Salucci's, nomination of that site for an EPA Superfund site because the groundwater was so contaminated. And the river, the Concord River, the uranium appeared to be moving towards that. It's very close to the river, the site. And the river is drinking water for another community, Belrica. And the soil, of course, is also contaminated. And the buildings would be hot there because of the manufacturing of the depleted uranium penetrator. So it then became apparent, I think, to our Board of Selectmen finally that we had a terrible mess there and they needed to support the site becoming an EPA Superfund site, which it has, and we are now in the process of having the full characterization of the site. And I don't want to not answer any questions, but I think it's important that you know, I wanted to emphasize for the veterans who are here in the room, that I think it's really important for returning Iraqi veterans to get tested for DU, to insist on it, and I think it's very important also for everyone in the room, including Veterans for Peace, to support the McDermott bill. Jim McDermott is a congressman who's a doctor, who has filed a bill in the U.S. House of Representatives that now has 35 sponsors. And that bill provides for health studies for all veterans in our country who have come back from places where DU was used or have been exposed to DU or believe they've been exposed to DU. So it's a very important piece of legislation for really getting started and trying to find out more about the health of our veterans from this standpoint of exposure to DU. Secondly, in addition to the bill, I've brought here a sample letter that people can use, and we have 35 sponsors now for that piece of legislation. 35. We need 15 more for a critical number. So I really urge any of you who are interested in, Jack and I have brought that with us. And finally, I just want to put in one more piece of one thing I want to tell you just about how we work. In Concord, we have a peace group that is excellent called Grassroots Actions for Peace. The citizens from that group are over doing a workshop at UMass for the social forum, and then some of us from Crew and Grassroots came here to be able to do this workshop, especially because Jack is a veteran and we live a mile and a half from this site, so this site, the nuclear metal site. But I did bring some facts for you that have been provided for Military Toxic Project, who was the first organization in our country to publish in 1993 a landmark piece on the use of DU here in our country and abroad, uranium battlefields at home and abroad, depleted uranium battlefields at home and abroad. So that's something that Military Toxics Project published. So I make this available. We have these on us today. I don't want to take up more time than that's available to me, but I do want you to know there are important developments that have taken place in Brussels this year in the forming of an international group to ban DU, which includes people from Japan, Iraq, the United States, United Kingdom, Germany, Italy, Brussels, Netherlands. They have a staff person, they have board of directors, they have groups working on funding and science. They have a day of action, an international day of action called for November 6th, and a petition that has been drafted and is being finalized now. So there is this is the work I know about. Michael, this is another Iraqi, returning Iraqi.
How do we get tested and what tests do we need to do? I went into the VA and asked about getting tested, and I was literally laughed at by the physician seeing me. And he laughed at me and said, what, are you trying to create more paperwork? So who do we talk to? Where do we go? What do we do?
Can I get to that in my comments? Yeah, we wanted to have all the panelists speak and then go into Q&A among all of us.
We will definitely get.
We expect some answers from you out there, too. So, Judy, thank you. You've brought up the international work, and I'd like to say that I believe veterans are really making an enormous difference on both the national scene and the international scene. We were privileged to get a phone call from Doug Rocky at Gulf War I vet, whom you saw in the amazing video. Reed, would you tell me how many of you have seen the film Invisible War? It's about an hour long. So only five out of this interested audience. I recommend it to you as a stunning documentary, which contains both the military perspective that this is a safe weapon and the alternate points of view of many scientists and veterans who find otherwise. So Doug Rocky researching the weapon did bring out many facts as he traveled to 30 cities and towns across the U.S., finding airtime of as much as an hour on public radio in Buffalo, New York, being on 45 stations in the Dakotas through the Greater Dakota News Service. Even though it was just a bit of morning and a bit of noon news, the word is beginning to get out. And then most recently, on April 4th, Juan Gonzalez broke the story of 9 veterans getting tested for uranium exposure through the Uranium Medical Research Center. And their website is umrc.net. It's a rather expensive test and a very accurate test using mass spectrometry, in which the urine sample is vaporized at a high temperature, and the various isotopes, the U-235, the U-236, if there's any, and the U-238, are shown to be in what exact proportions they exist. And in this way, one can distinguish between the very fine difference of profile between the natural uranium and the so-called depleted uranium, which just has a bit less U-235, which has been taken out. And so Juan Gonzalez reported, New York Daily News, Monday morning, April 5th, on Democracy Now!, he reported, and we heard directly from 3 of the 4 veterans who were confirmed for exposures. Dr. Tom Fazy of the Mount Sinai School of Medicine, a pathologist, said later by telephone that the VA retested those vets and found there was no problem. Tom was astute enough to ask the vets to get the explicit report, the lab report. He said it was laughable. The margin of error that they admitted in the report was so enormous. You might have as well said, well, we're not sure you have blood or not. You know, I mean, it was ridiculous. And that this hasn't come out yet in the press, only that there are 2 different findings when the tests are made. We're going to get to action planning with you at the end of this workshop, and let's talk about how to get more people tested. Other veterans helping. This book, the Little Green Book, Discounted Casualties, is so tremendous. It's only $12, and just a history of who's who in the historic DU movement. Jerry Wheat in... A veteran from Gulf War I speaks about the adverse health effects. And I'd heard that at least the veterans who had embedded shrapnel were getting care and attention. Little care and attention were those who've inhaled the dust, which is a very severe contamination. But unfortunately, Jerry reports that the care consists of only checkups about every 2 years. And when his father, who was a physician, made the diagnosis that his arm was producing a tumor in the area where the shrapnel was, the VA, yes, removed the tumor, but refused to give him any tissue samples for sending out for independent analysis. And so the policy of the military very clearly seems to be don't look, don't find. Don't find, don't tell. And the movement, veterans and peace activists together, physicians and doctors together, are speaking up and making this enormous difference. So who else is helping? Another veteran, Denise Nichols, was very helpful in publishing the level of casualties that actually existed from the Gulf War. Now, as veterans, you might know the numbers. The public imagines that Gulf War I was a rather quick feat, an aerial assault, and it was over, and our troops came home with only about 750 casualties, right, including the dead and wounded. But the numbers are obscurely published, and thanks to Denise Nichols, we've put them on our website, traprockpeace.org, and you can see the numbers, the breakdowns, 159,000 Gulf War I veterans on disability from the 1991 conflict and forwards, because the symptoms show up later in Gulf War syndrome, as of May 2002. At that date, 20,000 more applying for disability, 20,000 more denied a disability, and so the illness, the disease rate, I appreciate veterans for pointing out that this could be the Agent Orange of the new millennia. Yes?
So you don't forget the dead.
Oh, yes, don't forget the dead. Thank you. Over 10,000 dead since the 1991 conflict, a rate much higher than to be expected among a healthy population of young people.
And these were deaths that were deemed to be service-connected deaths.
Yes, absolutely.
Among Gulf War vets.
Service-connected deaths and the disabilities, always, you know, a need to prove the service-related connection. And that's...
And you said 150,000?
159,000.
And this as of 2 years ago.
As of May 2002. So who else is helping? The reporters are a tremendous help. The Japanese reporter who traveled around the world collecting those stories, Juan Gonzalez, as I said, and the reporters writing extensively in newspapers here and there in the small town press. We're finding that some progressive newspapers in major cities, as in Seattle, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer has covered this story very well. A newspaper out on the Olympic Peninsula carried a front page story with a veteran, Doug Rocky, and the local emergency room nurse came later that evening to the program outside the Navy's largest weapons depot on the Olympic Peninsula. And for the first time, the Navy admitted, yes, there is DU stored on site. Glenn Milner is an activist from the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action, and he is incredible about careful research. He found that transport of these radioactive materials is unknown and unlabeled. The military applied for an exemption from labeling, and one of the reasons they gave is that, well, we wouldn't want to alarm the public. If they saw explosive and radioactive labels on the same shipment, they might get concerned. This is actually in writing as one of the good reasons to not label. So if there's a highway accident, a fire, a rail yard accident, a shipping accident, where these tons and tons of material are shipped, no emergency responders have a clue that the problem has just begun. The fire is a problem. You can see it. But the particles in the air are concentrated. Now, in the film Invisible War, at one point, our friend, I believe it might have been Eric Daxon, is the one who said that you'd have to swallow enough of this material to choke on it for it to be a problem. And, of course, we'd like to invite him to give us a demonstration, you know, that it's not a problem to ingest it at all. But why is the lie that is given, how does it mislead? First of all, when they say uranium is ubiquitous in the environment, it's in garden soil, it's in drinking water, they're right. But it's only at a level of 2 to 4 parts per million, a very minuscule amount. On the for contrast, when a particle is ingested, one particle of this uranium oxide, which has become not water soluble and so less likely to dissolve and pass through the system, one particle of this concentrated ammunition could contain 1.7 trillion uranium atoms. And so even though it has a long half-life, the decay rate still could bombard your lung cells, not as an overall body dose, you know, that you're the random amount that you might get of radiation from the sun or the solar system, but a concentrated bombardment again and again and again and again within a diameter of only 5 cells. That's how far alpha particles, the largest particles, so damaging in their path, wrecking the genetic material, and disturbing the cells. I wonder if the technician has arrived that we called for. I think not. So we're not able to establish this phone line that we have ready. We have Chris Busby waiting in the UK for our call to him. And he explains very thoroughly why this problem exists. So I wonder if I might have some time to refer to what Chris would have told you about why this is damaging material. He explains something called the second event theory, which challenges, and he's challenged through the Royal Society in the UK, the entire paradigm on which radiation health effects have been based, which is external sources, saying that when the radiation source is localized, that first radioactive hit causes a cell to go into a state of anxiety, and in fact, cells in the whole network in an area as large as 300 cells adjacent are also disturbed. It appears that there's some kind of communication system that we don't understand among cells, and that their replication will begin after this kind of disturbance, this damage. During that cell replication process, about 10 hours into it, when the DNA is untwining, right? Remember the story? The DNA untwines, and another DNA forms alongside it and twines back up, and that's how you get two chromosomes, two nuclei forming, and then the cell divides. When a second hit of radiation from that very nearby localized internal source hits the cell during that replication process, the damage will be passed on to every cell produced following those two new cells that become damaged. And this is setting a new trend in the understanding of radiation health effects. We are really entering a new millennia. It's been 60 years that the paradigm of external radiation sources, when our government studied the effects in Hiroshima without giving care to the casualties, studied the American veterans who were the atomic veterans without giving care, real care, but just studied and watched what happened. The whole understanding is in a period of shifting now since Chris Busby's work in the mid-90s.
Dr. Busby is considered to be an expert by the Ministry of Defense. He's on the MOD's Depleted Uranium Oversight Board. He's
Thank
also
you.
The director of the low-level radiation campaign in the UK.
He disagrees with Dan Fay.
I'm just going to close my remarks when there's Dennis, whom you just heard, pictured. The day of action that Judy mentioned was decided upon as one of the action plans at the World Uranium Weapons Conference in Hamburg, Germany, in October of 2003. People from Australia, workers from the UK, Richard David, is suing the corporation, Honeywell, for his damage as a factory worker, and he's just won financial help for that lawsuit. He'd been taking it on, representing himself until now. The doctors from Iraq came and told us about the terrible death rate and the cancer rate and leukemia that the children are suffering. And I think that I just want to close saying the great effort is not only speaking up, but bringing forward the facts and information that as we all educate ourselves to become the best experts that we can be.